May it please the court.
Good morning.
Mark Anker Albert on behalf of the appellants, the debtor defendants, Sherry Fu, and the estate of her late husband, Thomas Fu. This court is faced with three non-dischargeable money judgments totaling over $72 million now with interest. They were entered based on a single summary judgment motion brought by one of the Fu's bank creditors, City National Bank. What's interesting about this case and makes it rare, including in the absence of applicable case law, is the fact that the summary judgment motion was served on the Fu's while they were incarcerated, indigent, and pro se.
Okay, but you got time and you got to respond to the summary judgment, so you got all of that, right?
The fact that we were able to, at the 11th hour, cobble together the best response that we could doesn't absolve the sophisticated creditor plaintiff from its own rule violations, such as, for example, the violation of their requirement under Local Bankruptcy Rule 7026 to serve with the summons and complaint a Rule 26 notice advising the debtor defendant of their discovery obligations.
I just don't see why at most it's not harmless error where the Fu's ultimately filed a complete and reasoned response to the summary judgment motion.
The reason that it's not a harmless error under Rule 61, Evidence Code 61 or an applicable case law, is when you add up the series of concatenated rule violations, together they serve to force the Fu's to railroad them into responding on drastically short notice to a financial death sentence motion. If the Fu's had been given proper notice under with the summons and the complaint under Rule 26 as it was required, if they were given the RAND notice, which was also not given to them, okay, if this motion had been served on them on their proper address, which the sophisticated plaintiff could have found just by checking the Bureau of Prisons inmate locator, right?
But they did serve. It was served at the address that they had lodged.
Right, and we argue that this court, as a court of equity and justice, should rule that in the case of an incarcerated, indigent, pro se defendant, that is insufficient for a sophisticated civil plaintiff to rely solely on the failure of the incarcerated defendant to update its address, but rather the last known address under Rule 5 should be deemed to be the address that's on the prison Bureau of Prisons inmate locator. Website.
So what you're saying is the City National Bank here shouldn't rely on the properly lodged address of the Fu's because it should know that the Fu's are in jail?
Yes, it did know that the Fu's were in jail.
They should know that the Fu's have no money?
Well, they knew that. The banks and, put the Fu's
and,
in jail.
And therefore they should call who to find out where the Fu's are?
Yeah, our position that in the unique circumstances where
can you answer me my question? I'm Mr. City National Bank, and I know that the Fu's are in jail. I know that they're out of money because they haven't paid off. And so I pick up the phone. Who should I call to say, well, that address they've given me is probably not good. Now, why do I think that?
A sophisticated plaintiff suing an incarcerated indigent pro se.
What about what are the elements of sophistication which give notice to the plaintiff that in this circumstance the address is not good?
It's not that. It's that.
But it is that. That's what I'd like you to tell me. What about Fu's being broke and being in proper and being in jail tells City National Bank the address which they've lodged is improper?
The first notice in the record that the address was incorrect is when the Fu's, Mrs. Fu's summary judgment papers were returned. That's the one item in the record that we know for sure put City National Bank on notice. What we're advocating for is a new affirmative duty. We think that, that the failure of an incarcerated indigent pro se defendant to update their address should be liberally excused, okay? And B, that the...
So you said a new affirmative duty, so you're asking for an extension of the law? Is that... My cross-examination skills sense you're asking for an extension by what you just said as opposed to what the existing law requires.
The existing law requires that in cases of pro se defendants in civil cases, that procedural errors are to be liberally excused. That is a well-established existing law. Okay, I'm saying that should also apply to the case where a civil defendant incarcerated pro se fails to update their answer.
Now, there's one thing you said that caught my ear. There was a return of mail to CNB?
Correct.
How did that occur?
Well, they served their motion for summary judgment with exactly 42 days as required under the applicable local bankruptcy rules. And they served it on mail to the last address that the FUS had put on their pro se answers. They were incarcerated in separate federal correctional facilities, okay, one in Alabama, one in Texas. He had since been released to a halfway house, so Mr. Fu never got the papers, and she had been moved from Aliceville in Alabama to Victorville.
You're saying that the service on Mrs. Fu, since she'd been moved, had been returned to CNB, saying we couldn't find her, she wasn't at this place?
Yes, Your Honor.
And when was that done? Was it still before the period to answer?
It's in the record. I don't know. I believe it was responded to them, yes. I think they got it back before him because they then tried to reserve it. It was returned again, and they finally got the correct address.
So what you're saying is that until it was finally served to where she was, time shouldn't start running?
I'm going beyond that. I'm saying, Your Honor, that the new law, not just an application of existing law of leniency for procedural errors for inmates, the new application should be that in the case of a plaintiff seeking ruinous, non-dischargeable money judgments against an incarcerated pro se defendant.
Well, it seems to me you're arguing structural error. You say alley, alley, oxen free because of this.
No. I'm saying that this is one of a series of errors that they made that served to railroad the FUS into responding on drastically short notice to a ruinous summary judgment motion, okay? And it's not immaterial, and it's not irrelevant, and it's not harmless error, because if they had been given more time, remember, they're indigent, they're in jail, they have to seek third-party funding to hire me. I wasn't retained previously, okay? So they have communication difficulties with the outside world, they have to arrange funding, and the fact that they're finally able to arrange funding to hire me to do an opposition in 10 days, okay, where I have no ability to meet with her, where I have to do the Rule 56 motion for discovery on my own, I don't even have time to get a declaration from the defendant, puts impossible pressure on an incarcerated civil defendant to adequately respond in time. It sets a bad precedent for the future, and the rule I'm talking about, a civil plaintiff should be required to check the prison, a Bureau of Prisons inmate locator to make sure that a civil defendant that's incarcerated is getting served at the correct
time. But then I guess it, in terms of, I'm wondering how you get past the fact that both of them entered a plea, and admitted fraudulent behavior, and there was a date. And so it would seem to me that October, what is it, on October 8th date, I think, is it?
The plea agreements say on a date.
It's an October 2008 date.
Yes.
Okay. It seems that two of the judgments strictly fall within that, maybe your best argument would be that I think it was the ABA facility that maybe the October 8th didn't cover, right?
That's correct. And
I mean, it seems that there, you know, if the October 2008 covers the other two, then how do you show whatever you would have discovered, you know, how could the result have been different?
The reason the case is not shut and the gavel doesn't come down, even though judgments number one and two reflect loans that were made during the applicable time period in the plea agreement, which is from October 2008 through June of 2009, was because while that may be dispositive as to the issue of non-dischargeability under Section 11 U.S.C. 523, it is not dispositive as to the liquidation of the amount of the obligation. Okay? So if the FOOS had been entitled to conduct discovery, which we requested, showing what happened to the fully 100% secured loans and the collateral that backed them up, the amount of the loan, the amount that the secured creditor actually obtained and therefore was owed, and their duty to mitigate those losses under their non-waivable obligation under Article 9 of the Commercial Code would have come into play. and we raised those arguments and preserved them on appeal. With respect to the May 2008 $130 million ABL facility, that falls outside the scope of the temporal scope of the plea agreement. Now, that's another error. Here, what the bankruptcy court did with the imprimatur of the district court is they said, because the plea agreement says on a date uncertain, but at least since October 2008, that's what it says, on a date unknown, but at least since October 2008. That's the operative language. What the bankruptcy court did with the blessing of the district court on the interim appeal on judgment number 1 and 2 said that that's strongly suggestive of prior period fraud. That ruling violates two cardinal principles, okay? One of the principles is that a plea agreement is a contract and the rule of contra preferentum applies. So if there's any ambiguity, it should have been applied in favor of the FOOS and against the drafters, okay? The second rule is that a plea agreement must accurately reflect the totality of the defendant's misconduct. Now here, the fact that the temporal language could be interpreted in favor of the FOOS, it could have been because it could have meant that it commenced sometime in October on a date uncertain, October 1st. Why is that interpretation not implausible or entitled to deference by this court? Because if the fraud had commenced earlier, the amount of the fraud, okay, of $4.7 million would have been substantially higher. It's critical, because if it had been higher, that would have impacted the FOOS sentencing and their restitution obligation. Instead, they were given a sentence that reflected the relatively minor, in terms of the bank's total loss, amount of their overstatements and overdrawing, $4.7 million. And it was reflected in their sentencing.
Well, it seems to me you're asking us to do the same that you're saying that they can't do. I mean, at best, it seems to me, I don't know what that means, what happened before October of 2008, but you're arguing, your best argument to me is that you say that it's a triable issue. But right. You're saying, well, the plea agreement means this, and they're saying, well, it means that.
We do argue that it presents a tribal issue. There's other errors. For example, the court disregarded Mrs. Fu's corroborating testimony. CNB claims, the appellee claims, that it was based on a sham declaration finding, but no such sham declaration finding was ever made. The inconsistency for the sham doctrine to apply has to be clear and unambiguous. And here, as I said, because of the proper application of the inferences in favor in opposing summary judgment,
they would have had to make a finding that it was a sham.
And they didn't do that. And it's not clear and unambiguous because there's waffling on the timing of whether it started at the beginning of October or sooner. And then, secondly, there was no discovery permitted and allowed for me to subpoena and depose either the prior accountants who verified the GUSA Gallery USA financial statements, that the bank examiners that did comprehensive inventory audits and field audits that showed that that there was adequate collateral in the form of inventory and accounts receivable to secure these loans, and the PricewaterhouseCoopers validation of the income and assets of the company in its tax returns. No discovery was permitted on that, and the FOOS declaration was summarily dismissed without making a correct sham declaration finding. All of these things together, an improper application of the standards for the interpretation of a plea agreement, together with the denial of our opportunity to conduct any discovery, concerning the finances, the accuracy of the finances of the company prior to October 2008, together with the short notice, all add up to a due process violation and a deprivation of justice.
Do you want to save any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
As much as Your Honor will give me. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Michael Fainter and Jeffrey Reisner on behalf of City National Bank.
Will you be making all the argument?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
All of the material facts are undisputed, and additional discovery or parties didn't change a thing. The Foos procured money under all three loans because they lied about their inventory and accounts receivable.
Well, okay, I guess just sort of jumping right to it, and I'm only speaking for myself. We haven't conferenced on this, so I'm not speaking for... It seems to me that the strongest argument that they make goes to the last contention under ABL in terms of, in Van Asdale versus International Game Technology, we stated that to disregard an affidavit for contradicting a prior statement, the inconsistency must be clear and unambiguous. Ms. Foos's plea agreement did not state that the fraud began before October 2008, nor did it state that it began as early as May 2008. How does her statement in her declaration that the fraud began in October 2008 create a clear and unambiguous inconsistency with the plea agreement, and there isn't a finding of a sham affidavit? So that's the one that I'm saying, how do you get around that one? I mean, other than that the court looked at it and said, okay, it clearly covers the other two, this dog don't hunt, let's just get rid of the whole thing, and, you know, and made the assumption, well, it must have began before then.
Actually, the answer to that question, I believe, is relatively simple, which is that Mrs. Foos's declaration doesn't show any issue of material fact at all. When the fraud started, whether it was May of 2008 or October 2008, first of all, from a fundamental baseline, it doesn't matter.
So you agree that it wasn't, there is no finding that it was a sham affidavit.
I agree there's no finding there's a sham, but there doesn't need to be. And if I can explain for two reasons, I'd like to try and do that. The May 2008 loan is actually the ones the Foos pled guilty to and said if the banks had known what was going on, they wouldn't have given us the money. And that's because of the interesting nature of the May 2008 loan as opposed to the other ones. Your Honor is exactly correct. The other two are covered. The May 2008 loan is a revolving loan, which means...
Let's see if I understand you. In the plea before the court on the bank fraud counts, you're representing that in answer to the charge as to the May loan, the Foos admitted that the material they submitted to CNB was fraudulent?
Yes.
And where do I find that in the record?
It's in the compendium of exhibits. The it's for both Sheree and Thomas Foo.
Give me the record citation of that, would you please?
Exhibits 25 and 26. And I will use the numbers from the, I know the appeal is confusing because there are two separate appeals. The Bates numbers from AER.
These are not exhibits to the plea agreement. They're
the plea agreement itself.
I've got the plea agreement here. Tell me what about the plea agreement says that the Foos admit to May 2008 fraud.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. To be clear, they admit to fraud on the May 2008 loan.
Okay.
The May 2008 loan, as I hopefully can explain.
And where in the plea agreement do I look to see that to confirm your statement?
It's at AER 4486 at 4490. For Mrs. Foo,
4426 to 4490?
4486.
86.
And 4490. At paragraph, I believe it's between 10 and 14, the FOOs admit to fraud on this facility. And that's because this facility is a revolving one. They submit declarations of what's called a borrowing. They say, we have this much collateral, we have this much inventory, we have this much inventory in transit. And they do that every month. And each month they submit that. That determines how much they can borrow that month. They keep submitting them every month. And they admit in the plea agreement, as well as in their papers before this court, they lied about it in October, November, December 2008, all the way through June 2009. And on the basis of those repeated lies every month, they got the banks to loan them more money.
But you started with the lies as of October 2008.
She says she started with the lies on October 2008, but that's on the May 2008 loan. That's a living loan where it consists of them reborrowing money from us every month.
Maybe I'm not myself clear. Where in the record is there an admission that in procuring the May 2008 loan, the FOOs, both of them, admitted to committing bank fraud?
The FOOs admitted to committing bank fraud in the plea agreements because they were...
And I have a plea agreement here, and what I'm asking you, Mr. Fainer, is if you would be so kind to give me the page of the plea agreement. I have EA 1809 through EA 1824, or 25, I'm sorry. Tell me where in that plea agreement does it say that the May 2008 loan was procured by bank fraud.
It does not say that the May 2008 loan at the beginning was procured by bank fraud, but they got money under that loan document in the later months.
Well, but they're acknowledgement of bank fraud started in October 2008. So if your claim is that these judgments are non-dischargeable because of fraud in the inception of the loan, you've got to show me some evidence that at the inception of the May 2008 loan, the representations that were made by the FOOs were false.
And I will show you that at the inception of the loans, we do have the evidence in the record that it is false. However, I do want to make the point that since it's a revolving loan, they can lie after May 2008 and still cause our losses on that loan, because we know for a fact they lied for at least 9 months on that revolving loan. They also lied to get the other two loans, and that's established.
Is your position that as to the May loan, the consideration by the lender was not all made in May, but it was made later on?
Yes, that's the nature of a revolving loan, which is on the basis of the base borrowing certificates that they submitted to us.
Was any loan made liquid and available to the FOOs by the lender on the May 2008 loan before October 2008?
Yes, there was.
How much?
I'm not sure that is in the record. I'm happy to submit something after this.
Well, following up on Judge Callahan's question, if there's no evidence in the plea agreement that the representations for the May 2008 loan were fraudulent and admitted to be fraudulent, the money that was forwarded by the May 2008 loan until October 2008 would not be confessedly fraudulent, correct?
If it's not confessed by the plea agreement, I believe that's correct. But there is undisputed evidence that there was ongoing fraud in May 2008, whether Mrs. Fu indicates that in her plea agreement or not.
Well, but maybe the thing to do is to remand this to the district court for the district court to make such a finding, because I don't find it.
It is not required for Judge Albert or Judge Carney, the district court or the bankruptcy judge, Judge Albert, to make a sham declaration finding in order to find that the summary judgment needle hasn't been moved. What Mr. Albert did, what Judge Albert did, was to say, here I'm looking at a new declaration, one from Mrs. Fu that says, contrary to what the plea agreement says, which says at least since October 2008, and now it remembers, oh, it is October 1, 2008, what can I do to go against all this evidence that the borrowing-based certificates never changed, like the laws of nature or economics would command if a huge-scale fraud, which was admitted in the plea agreement, 10 to 20 times or 100 times the inventory and collateral, if that started in October 2008, the numbers reported to the banks must have changed as a matter of physics. And I believe that the U.S. Supreme Court indicated that such implausible testimony, unbelievable testimony, contrary to the undisputed facts in the record, does not prevent summary judgment. In Anderson, the Supreme Court said, documents or objective evidence may contradict the witness's story, or the story itself may be so internally inconsistent or implausible on its face that a reasonable fact finder would not credit it. And the phrase, the reasonable fact finder, goes back to Anderson versus Liberty Lobby, which says, yes, you have to be able to show that a reasonable jury would buy your story. And the Supreme Court said again in Scott versus Harris, when opposing parties tell two different stories, one of which is blatantly contradicted by the record so that no reasonable jury would believe it, a court should not adopt that version of facts for purposes of ruling on a motion of summary judgment. Now, the respondent's version of events there is so utterly discredited by the record that no reasonable jury could have believed it. And the court also said that in the Cleveland versus
Pollard. But you seem to be arguing that the admitted fraud from October 2008 forward was so egregious that no reasonable person would think that a loan was made on any other than a fraudulent basis in May of 2008. Is that your point?
No, with all respect, I
okay, pardon me.
I don't think it is, Your Honor. In terms of the loan, there were three loans that went into May 2008, October 2008, and then May 2009. The banks provided that money. However, what's important is the non-dischargeability standard in the bankruptcy code. And it, what's important about that is under the non-dischargeability provision, it's either an extension or a renewal of credit that is based on fraud that isn't discharged in bankruptcy. We don't let the debtors discharge that debt. Each month, that loan was renewed, the May 2008 one, on the same basis of the same numbers, the same fraudulent inventory, which now it is no surprise that nobody could not find.
Are you saying that if I said hypothetically I've got 100,000 widgets sitting here to secure this loan in September and you can't find them, the same statement that I have 100,000 widgets to secure this loan was made in May, so that you have the same statement that happens to be admitted in September, but it's the same statement that was made in May, and there's not any evidence that would have shown that things had changed so much that the 100,000 widgets disappeared between May and October.
I could not have said it better myself, Your Honor. It's, they keep repeating the same lie and keep getting money for the same lie under the revolving loan.
Is there anything different about the ABL facility loan?
The ABL facility, it stands for asset-based lending, so it's different because the other two were more standard loans. Asset-based lending, the money comes in through the borrowing base. The FUS report that their company has so much inventory.
Well, did the court make any – is the court's basis for granting summary judgment on that loan, did the court – is the court's reasoning a little bit different than the other two?
Yes, it is.
And if so, explain that to me.
Okay. The court said, we'll give Mrs. Fu the benefit of the doubt because we have this May to October 2008 time period. All right. So we will hold – that's the reason he held open judgment on this May 2008 loan. He said, Mrs. Fu, you have the duty to come in and show me that the fraud was not ongoing during this period. And he said, just coming in and saying you deny it won't be enough, because under Rule 56D and the family home factors, which were recently affirmed by this court in the Midtown flower bulb case, you have to show that the facts exist and that they matter. And the Fus failed to show that any facts existed, even after 16 months of discovery on this very loan that we're talking about.
But the court looked at her affidavit, right?
The court looked at her affidavit and
said... And didn't find that it was a sham.
He did not use the word sham in his opinion. That's correct. But under Scott versus Harris or Anderson, he didn't have to, because under the Liberty Lobby standard for Rule 56 summary judgment, just coming in and saying something doesn't mean that a reasonable jury is going to believe it. A non-movement for summary judgment has the benefit for all unreasonable inferences.
Okay, let me ask you this. This is on a different, sort of where we started on the other side. You argue that CNB's summary judgment papers were timely served on the Fu's counsel, but their counsel did not formally appear as counsel in the CNB action until after receiving the motion. How is that service timely and proper?
The service is timely and proper because Mr. Albert had appeared at a status conference in this adversary proceeding in August.
Is Mr. Anker not? Did you say Mr. Albert?
It's the same last name, so the judge's name gets confusing sometimes.
Oh, okay.
It's Mr. Anker Albert.
Anker Albert. Okay. All right. So we're not talking the judge. We're talking the counsel.
Exactly.
All right.
And so he did appear in this adversary proceeding, which is a subset of the Fu's bankruptcy. He did appear at a status concert. He also appeared as counsel of record in the U.S. trustee dischargeability proceeding. And this is another reason why we know that the Fu's knew that Rule 56 was a big deal, because before City National Bank ever served their adversary proceeding, Mr. Albert was representing the Fu's in the other Rule 56 non-dischargeability motion brought by the U.S. trustee. That one, the Fu's lost, despite Mr. Albert's advocacy, because Mrs. Fu had lied to the court. And perjury is also a basis for finding a debt non-dischargeable. So we served the Fu's at their last known address, and we served Mr. Albert, and we served Mr. Smiley, who had been able to obtain two extensions of time to answer CNB's complaint.
So Mrs. Fu is still alive, but Mr. Fu passed.
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay.
And I don't know if Your Honor wants me to explain any more, but we served the Fu's at the addresses that we had, and that had worked for all our previous status reports, and it had worked for everything else. We served Mr. Albert. Mr. Albert, in his Rule 56D declaration, indicated he did not pass on the material to the Fu's because he presumed that they had been served wherever they were. He did not tell us that they had moved. And now it sounds like Mr. Albert is introducing a new federal rule of civil procedure where Rule 5 doesn't apply, and that an inmate locator website, which even he admits in his Rule 56 declaration may or may not be up to date, is now a new requirement for serving folks in prison. And that the rule of bankruptcy procedure saying the debtor's address must be up.
Could I direct your attention to Mr. Albert's bringing up the issue of one of the matters served was returned because Mrs. Fu wasn't at that prison?
Yes.
So when you got that, what did you do?
Then we did some of our own research. This is in the Lyman Declaration, mm-hmm. in the record, as well as the Appellee's Appendix. We looked for addresses where she might be. We found that she may have been moved based on our own research, and we sent it there. Contrary to what's in the briefs and what I heard today, Mr. Fu's service copy was never returned. There was no return on that. After serving the new prison that we found out about, then the prison had some regulations that we should follow to write on the outside of the package certain things about to be opened in the presence of the admittee. So he sent it again. And if Your Honor was wondering about timeline, I certainly have it here.
But what I'm trying to find, I'm trying to deduce from this argument, is how long before the hearing was actual service made on Mrs. Fu?
The
hearing, at her new prison location.
Okay. The hearing, supplemental service at the new prison location was October 9th, 2014. Supplemental service on with the additional writings, November 4th. The original service on the Fus, Mr. Albert and Mr. Smiley, was October 23rd. The response was November 13th. As Mr. Albert says in his declaration, CNB's counsel offered to give Mr. Albert another week. He declined because there was no guarantee that Judge Albert would move the hearing date.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you. Unless my colleagues have any questions, we've taken a little bit over your time. Thank you very much. Yes. You have 4 minutes and 51 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the Sherry Fu declaration, appellees seem to be arguing that notwithstanding the fact that there was no sham declaration finding by the court, notwithstanding the fact that the purported inconsistency is not clear and unambiguous with respect to the timing of the fraud in relation to the plea agreement, that the bankruptcy court was still entitled to completely disregard it because it was implausible, because of the consistency in the borrowing-based certificates that were provided. What appellee fails to note, however, is that Mrs. Fu's testimony was corroborated by independent third-party evidence that the bankruptcy court did not permit me to explore that I went over previously with you previously, namely that the audited financial statements that audited by a licensed CPA, the Gayton firm, the tax returns of the company that were audited by...
So are there some assets?
Well, that's Judge Whaley said, well, if you said there was 100,000 widgets at the beginning and you lie about the 100,000 widgets at the end, maybe you were lying about the 100,000 widgets at the beginning. But here, the inventory, both landed and in transit, because some's in a warehouse and some is on a ship, and the accounts receivable were extensively audited, and it's in the record, including affirmed by CNB's own declarants that a comprehensive field audit had been done at the time, but before the May 2008 ABO facility was approved. In other words, they went in and approved, based on their comprehensive examinations, that there was sufficient inventory and AR, accounts receivable, to justify the issuance of this $130 million loan. And these are sophisticated banks that hired sophisticated audit specialists to conduct the inventory and accounts receivables audits.
That's a long answer to, are there some assets?
Yeah, there were. That's what I'm saying. It was a fully 100% collateralized loan that was verified by independent audits conducted by the banks.
Well, no, but I mean, if the Fus have no money, I hope we're not fighting about nothing.
Oh, do the Fus have money? No, the Fus are still, well, the estate is in bankruptcy, and Mrs. Fu are still in Chapter 7 bankruptcy. The bankruptcy actions have not closed. So there's very little chance that the banks will be collecting on this. So you're saying, why are they fighting so hard? That's something you have to address to Mr. Fainer. So my point on the Fu declaration is that the implausibility argument as a justification for disregarding the declaration, even though there's no sham declaration finding and the requirements which you're finding were not met, does not hold water because of corroborating third-party evidence and the substance of her testimony as well. Then, with respect to the service issue, the fact I did not appear in the CNB action, there was a status conference in the U.S. trustee action, okay, which I attended that day. And right afterwards, CMB came up. And when I was at the podium, Judge Albert said, would I be appearing as counsel for the Fus in the CMB action? And I told him I had not been retained yet. And if you look at the tentative ruling that was adopted as a final opinion for judgment number 1 and 2, he says service on the soon-to-be-retained counsel, which is a refutation the service on me at that time was, as a matter of law, consistent with being served as counsel of record. Now, I represent many corporations over the years, and I represent individuals. Representation in one matter does not mean you're representing them in all the others. Okay, and I was not had not represented her, and was not retained until 10 days before the motion response was due. And so that was two. So then, with respect to service on the Foos, esteemed counsel made clear before this court today that even when they tried to reserve it, it was sent back because they hadn't complied with Bureau of Prison service requirements for legal documents. You have to say to be open in attorney's eyes only, et cetera. They didn't do it. They didn't do it the first time they served it either, right? So even the first time they served, even if they got the address wrong, with 40 days, they served exactly 42 days before the hearing was set, which is the shortest notice possible. It would have been incorrect because they didn't follow Bureau of Prison guidelines. So we believe that an injustice was done here. There was a rush to judgment. The bankruptcy court had made a finding that Mrs. Fu had lied to him when the underlying bankruptcy case with respect to their involuntary bankruptcy was supposed to go to trial. She presented a trial declaration where she basically denied having committed fraud. And the U.S. trustee came in, and on an 11 U.S.C. 727 action, got a non-dischargeability determination before this hearing, before the summary judgment was open, where Judge Albert had said that Mrs. Fu had lied to him, and so he was not going to grant her discharge. So the bankruptcy judge, who I have tremendous respect for, very intelligent and thorough, had already made a determination that Mrs. Fu was a liar.
Okay, you're over time, so please conclude.
So there was a rush to judgment, and we hope this court will grant justice.
Thank you both for your argument. We appreciate that. This matter will stand submitted.